You have found Authentic Business Adventures, a business program that brings you the struggle, stories, and triumphant successes of business owners across the land, coming to you from the great Carbon 4 Brewery. I'm excited here. We have Zach Koga, the co-owner of Carbon 4. How are you doing today,
Zach? I'm doing well. Doing well. Another week.
Yeah.
It's Monday. Yeah.
That's how we owners do it here. This is a cool space you got here.
Thank you.
So let's start out with, how long have you been here?
We are in our ninth year. So we got 8 full years, technically December 28th of 2020. So
nice.
We're rolling into our ninth year here.
Wow.
And many more to come.
All right. That's super cool. So was this the first spot or did you relocate?
This was our first spot. We started here. Ale Asylum was here from about somewhere in 2006 until late summer, roughly.
Right.
Late summer, fall of 2012.
Okay.
And then we moved in. Our lease started October of 2012, and we were open by the end of the year. So about, well, it's almost 3 full months to get us open, but that's pretty fast.
I was going to say, it's crazy fast.
Yeah, we were working 100-hour weeks, just going straight through every day, every night to get open. And we had the benefit of Ale Asylum being here before, so a lot of infrastructure things were already here.
All right.
Drainage, water, boiler, stuff.
Right.
So it was more rearranging our first equipment setup mixed with some things we bought from them versus things we brought in. And then in the tap room, they had a functioning tap room here. We ended up kind of gutting it, so we went a little further than we thought we would. But there was already half of the bar was here already. Plumbing things, a lot of things were here, so that helped us get to market pretty quickly.
Very cool. Is that why you ended up choosing this space, or were you deliberating other spaces as well?
Yeah, we at the end of the day, that's why we ended up in this space in Madison. We were talking about how to start a brewery for a couple of years. My brother is really what brings me into the beer business. I'm an engineer by training and background, and my brother was brewing beer out in Montana for several years. As a family, we were talking about how to get a brewery going for ourselves, for him, more focused for him and for his career. And then as that discussion got more real, I was getting kind of more involved, looking at the business plan with him, and brought in some friends to help us. And then Ryan cold called Ale Asylum and just kind of said, hey, we're looking to start up a brewery. Madison's definitely on our radar because I'd already lived here. He was out in Montana, and it's a great, great city, great market for craft beer, especially back then, almost 10 years ago. And we sort of struck a deal to say, hey, I think there's certain things that you're probably just trying to sell, and they'd be worth more if they stayed put to both of us. And
so at the time, you knew Ale Asylum was leaving?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were aware. So I worked for Findorff before starting the brewery, and so I was always very aware of real estate development and projects and things in town. So I was aware that Ale Asylum was looking to build a new space. At the time, I knew more about some of their early plans when they were looking at East Washington. But that fell through before they ended up out on the other side of the airport. And Ryan was really the one that had the insight to say, hey, they're expanding, and I bet they're going to try to sell some equipment. And it's a leased space. I know the landlord here. And we just, put things together from there.
Right. Yeah. So when Ryan cold called them, were they just like, well, that's good timing.
Yeah, I it was luck. It was good insight and foresight by Ryan, but it was also some luck because, I think we get, as a business owner, you get solicited all day, every day, 24/7, in the mail, on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Employees get harassed. People pretending that they knew you from high school and stuff,
right?
And family you've never met. The fact that Otto just actually took the call was lucky, I think, just to actually get to the office.
Right.
And then he listened, and I think it was wow, that's good timing. Yeah.
Nice. And was there ever any thought of hey, I don't want to help out a competitor or anything like that?
Not really. I think there was some concern because we had some conversation about, hey, you're going to change this, right? You're not just going to totally rip us off.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, absolutely. We have our own ideas about what we want to do and what our brand's going to be like. We're definitely going to make changes. So there was a little bit of discussion of hey, you're going to at least kind of repaint and redecorate and make sure it's not confusion in the market about it being an Ale Asylum affiliated company.
Right.
But overwhelmingly, they were real easy to work with and friendly, and we got through, you know, we got through it.
Nice. That's super cool.
Yeah.
Did you end up, I guess as far as their landlord goes, was it complicated? Or was it easier because you guys are a brewery, so the landlord didn't have to get rid of a bunch of stuff?
The landlord was, that was probably the easiest part. Nice. I mean, he's like, great, I don't have any vacancy and it's the same purpose. And he probably did pretty well in the deal because when Ale Asylum took it over, I think it was much cheaper space. It wasn't really retail focused space. And and so them turning it into a brewery and having the tap room put it in a different category, you know, as hybrid retail rent instead of more like East Side warehouse rent.
Right.
So I think he did okay on it. And we've certainly paid all our bills along the way. So we have a good relationship, and it was very simple to get through that part.
Cool. Yeah. I'm going to pause for a second. Just make sure this is recording. It's so far away, I can't see the dog. It is recording.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just like, is that dot on?
Yeah.
So as far as the build out and stuff like that goes, I remember being in Ale Asylum and then coming in here thinking this is just going to be the same thing, and it was way different.
Yeah.
But still cool. I mean, Ale Asylum back in the day was cool, and this was a cool place. It's interesting because I have no eye for aesthetics, but I know when I like it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. We're not interior designers or decorators by any stretch of the imagination, but we certainly developed a point of view. I think our approach coming into the tap room was that we wanted it to be a canvas that we got to build the brand out on. And one of our best friends, Tom, was an early creative force in the company and did all the paintings in the brewery. And we wanted it to be a canvas for his interpretation on our beer brands as we went.
Oh, nice.
So we filled up the space with his paintings. Every time we would release a beer, we would release a painting with it until we ran out of room, basically.
Wow.
And so that's kind of helped bring it to life a little bit. When we also, during COVID, used the opportunity to repaint and clean some things up. So right now, it's actually kind of a lighter palette than it was when we first opened. It was a little darker. But that was the concept, because we probably could have done better on an interior decorating side, but we did what we could do, and it worked for a while.
Sure, hindsight.
Now we're evolving,
it's all good.
So, yeah.
I do remember it being really dark in here.
Yeah.
But I guess I didn't necessarily consider that a bad thing. It was.
Yeah, it was a bar. I mean, it's a bar tap room. Yeah, right. It's not. Yeah, so it worked.
That's cool. So tell me about how it's been working with your brother. I guess it's probably a safe place here.
Oh, yeah.
But working with family is going to be tough.
It is, but not... he and I have not had, I think, those typical cliche family problems all the time. Not at a high level. There's certainly... You disagree on things, or you're both tired or both grumpy, and you get into it on whatever the issue is. But he and I have... it's never been like that kind of cliche problem that's like,
awesome.
Boy, we're just gonna never talk again and not get over it. And
slamming doors.
We've been able to separate how tired or frustrated or whatever it is with the problems and with the issues versus each other. We've always been able to keep those things kind of separate. It's definitely evolved our relationship because we're working together every day instead of goofing off as brothers, you know. And when we go home and be social, we're getting to do that separately. So, you know, it certainly changed like how often we might just hang out because we're together all the time. But I think we both really valued all the time we got to spend together too, because we're just totally in tune on like everything with each other. You know, we know each other inside out, up and down, at our best and at our worst, and we have each other's back. You know, we really
just
unequivocally support each other. If you get a phone call at 10 o'clock, something broke, we're both no questions asked, we'll work through the night, fix it, whatever has to be done. So I think the way to survive that is just to never give up, you know, on the problems. And if you don't do that, then you're not ultimately betraying each other, and then you don't get into those tough problems, you know.
Totally
as long
fair.
As you're both in the fight together, you're in the fight together.
So I want to back up a step to when he's in Montana, and you at the time are in Madison, working for Findorff. Did he reach out to you and say, hey, let's start a brewery?
No, it wasn't like that so much. It was more an evolution, I would say. He had gotten a master's in strength and conditioning out at MSU Billings, and initially started working at a brewery for a part-time job just to pay the bills and while he was in school.
All right.
Wasn't a huge beer guy. Has always been a cheap date. Doesn't drink a lot of alcohol in general. But he was on the bottling line and had their Black Widow oatmeal stout like short fill off the line with lunch, and had a real moment of clarity about like, oh my gosh, this is like totally different than the beer I've been familiar with growing up, and felt I've been lied to about what beer is and what it should be and what it could
this
be.
This isn't
and all these
macro
things.
Light beer.
Yeah, this isn't whatever, you know, light. And so he started to get really passionate about it. He's a very sort of passion-driven guy, artistic guy, but also very technical person. And it was a real outlet for him. It was such a muse that once he stumbled into this, wow, beer could be these other things, you know, realization, he really ran at it pretty quickly. And by the time he was out of school, he was working his way, you know, towards brewing and ultimately being the head brewer out at Yellowstone Valley Brewing Company and being a pretty major person running the operations there. And he was getting better at his craft. He was getting better at his seasonal program. He was getting, you know, out in the community, and his bright personality was, you know, creating a following. And so as just a family talking, you know, about life along the way, student debts, you know, starting to be due, and you know, I want to get married and start a family. And it was this question of, okay, are you going to keep doing this? You know, how serious are you about this? And I think we should be looking for opportunities with a little higher ceiling. So it was a real evolution. I mean, all the way up until working through the business plan, he was still looking for opportunities to maybe go back to PA school or get another job, you know, associated with his education. And once we stumbled on this being an exact opportunity in this location with this timeline, things started to fall into place faster, and we got a lot more confident about, hey, this is a real plan with a real location with a real timeline, you know, and it gave a lot of foundation to our plan. And then we went out and pitched an investor, and the first one we met with said yes, and we were like, oh wow,
the first one.
So he ultimately ended up not being a partner of ours, so but it gave us a ton of confidence to have somebody say, this is the plan. And I still remember he looked right at us and he said, so you guys are the guys? And we said, yes. And he said, I'm in. And we're like, wow, what just happened?
Are you sure?
Yeah, what just happened? Us? And I still owe that guy a bottle of scotch or something, I think, because I don't know if we didn't really talk much after that, because plans started accelerating in another direction. And but it gave us tons of confidence to say, we're doing this. This isn't an if thing. This is a when thing. And we accelerated from there and got it going. So it wasn't so much him calling and saying, let's do this. It was more of just this ongoing discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, what are we doing? Are you going to do this? And then it really wasn't my focus initially, but just as time kept going on, I got more involved in helping structure the business plan. Ryan had this real brilliant friend out in Montana that was helping him just kind of get the business plan organized. And we started working with our friend Alex. We brought him in to help as well. He was in between things and had some more time to throw into it to help make sure we stayed aggressive on making it happen.
Did your brother ever have to sell you on it? Like, dude, this is really happening kind of thing?
No.
Or was there ever, like, you were at the time working at Findor, so you had a pretty decent job.
I was really busy. I was really busy, and my job at Findor was going very well. Mm-hmm. It's a great company. I mean, my plan was to try to be an owner there, you know?
Yeah.
I had kind of big dreams no matter where they were, you know. Mm-hmm. Before all of that, I wanted to play professional baseball. Then I switched away from that, I was like, oh, I'm going to be an engineer and I want to own the construction firm, you know, or be a developer and own the buildings. And I always had that kind of itch to be in control of my destiny a little bit. So that was going really well, but I was having a bit of a quarter life crisis that I I was managing a big project in Milwaukee. I had to have been about the youngest guy running a high-rise project in an urban city in the country, and I had this just sort of quarter-life crisis moment of like, what is this it? You know, is this I'm just going to chase this same sort of thing for the next 20 years or 30 years? And it freaked me out a little bit, and I was getting more and more of an itch to do something entrepreneurial. So the brewery really gave me an outlet, because I didn't really know what it would be if I did something else. I just knew that I could bring project management and business and engineering skills to something.
Yeah.
And the brewery was the outlet for me at the time. And,
nice. Yeah. That sounds like a lot of stars aligned really well.
Oh yeah, it very much, because it wasn't Ryan's big master plan, you know, when he went out to Montana either, and a lot of things had to come together. And at the end of the day, it's just willpower.
Totally.
Oh, I mean, I think that's the secret to all of life. You know, ideas are a dime a dozen. I think a lot of people overvalue ideas. It's execution and willpower.
Totally. I was talking to the guy. Yeah. He's like, I'm an idea man. I'm like, everyone's an idea.
Everybody has an idea. I mean, we could sit here together. I was listening to somebody make a comment like, you know, if we sat down for an hour, we could probably chart out everything that's going to happen over the next like 50 to 100 years.
Sure.
You know, you can talk about AR, VR, all the electrical stuff and digital things and the way crypto's going and NFTs, and it's not that hard to see where all of these things are going and what our life could be like. It's execution. I mean, it's there's really not.
Yeah.
You don't need to wait around for ideas. You just need to do things and turn it into business. And it's really hard. It's still very hard for us today. I mean, just to stay relevant, to stay in business. Really, I still feel very much like a startup. I don't feel like we figured out.
After 9 years.
Oh, yeah. I don't feel like we've hardly even gotten started. Yeah.
I can totally. My business is 9 years as well, and I can say that there are days. Is this day two?
Yeah.
Like, where are we at? Have we learned nothing?
We've learned nothing. Yeah. There's so many things that we do wrong or not as well as I'd like to. And I talk with a lot of people that have the same dream I did. You know, if I was in charge, I would just do all of these things.
Yeah,
it would be perfect.
Easy.
It would be utopia. And then you start doing it and realize, oh no, it's messy and complicated. And really the whole magic is, can you operate it? Not do you have ideas or have dreams or utopian visions. It's more like, can you grind it day in and day out?
Right.
Can you make small steps forward and make more of them forward than backward?
Are you willing to?
Are you willing to? Yeah. And is your family willing to go along for that ride?
I mean, great segue, because that was the next question. How are you married, or were you married at the time?
So the year we opened, I opened that high-rise building in Milwaukee. I got married, and we opened the brewery within 3 months of each other.
Nice.
I didn't sleep for about 3 months.
Wow.
You know, it was a great year.
So I am married.
I have three daughters now.
Oh, nice.
My wife, Laura, and I live out in Wanakee now. We have three little girls, beautiful girls. We, at the time she was getting her doctorate in nursing that year as well. She'd gone back to school. So she was an RN in school to get her doctorate to be a nurse practitioner. I was just killing myself driving to Milwaukee and back every day running that project, opened the brewery, got married. And then when we had our first daughter, about a year and a half later, that was the moment that I knew I had to quit my day job at Findor.
Okay, so I was going to ask you when you walked into that office and said, hey.
That was the hardest thing.
I bet.
I don't know if it's the hardest thing, but like one of the hardest things in my life. I'll never forget. I was absolutely dreading having that discussion, because like I said, I was really working my tail off there. It was a great company. I was treated well. I felt like I was on the right path to be in a leadership position there. And I was overseeing a handful of pretty large projects that were kind of coming down the pipeline, and to have to walk in and I know just really, you know, ruin the day for my boss to be like, sorry, I have to go, and like, here's all this stuff I'm dealing with for you, and I'm gone.
Here's my stack of headaches.
Yeah, like, sorry. It was pretty tough. a guy I really admire, Jim Yaley. He's now the president and CEO of Findorf. That's who I went and talked to. I had my box all packed up in case they just had to walk me out, because I respect that. You know, sometimes you have to just do that. But since I was changing industries, it was a little easier to say, let's just transition you out over like a two-week period and help. I can help, you know, with the transition and help them figure out how to reallocate the workload. And so very difficult decision, but it was the most clarity I've ever felt in my life, I think, was like the moment my daughter Sloane was born. It was just, it was a very weird kind of out-of-body experience for a lot of reasons, I think, maybe a lot of parents could relate to. But for me in particular, just going crazy about what should I do? Should I leave my job? It was just, it was immediate. I quit. I cannot, the risk of missing more time with this girl.
Your priorities changed.
Oh, it just changed. It was just not even close.
So you don't even get a choice in the matter.
It's not even close. Like, it just wasn't a problem. I can always work. I can't, you know, this is my daughter.
Right. So. They're only young ones. That's fair. Yeah. So how long were you with Findorf then?
About 7 years, 6 or 7 years. I started interning, pretty full-time interning in college, and then just transitioned right out of college. So it was somewhere like 07 to, somewhere in 07, 6 or 7 to April of 14. So six, 7 years.
All right. Dang. It's the time when you get in the car after you have that conversation. You're like,
It was liberating because it just to make a decision and move forward. Right. But it was pretty horrifying because I felt like I had really let Jim down and my coworkers there that they wouldn't understand I'm leaving, you know, because we're all these like, I don't know, self-abusing engineer types in the construction industry, like very dutiful, work really hard. You know, there's nothing better than building projects. We love projects. And I am that person. I love that. But but to leave and start a brewery, it was kind of like, what?
You know? What are you doing?
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
But they were cool about it. They're very cool about it. Still supportive. I still work. They do small projects for us around the brewery still. There's guys just up the road at the Eurofins building that they just built. The project team comes down to get beers after work sometimes.
Nice. And no bad blood.
It's none at all.
Life is all about choices.
It's just that, it was just a veer in my path. You know, they're great company. No bad blood at all.
Yeah. I interviewed Chad over at Findorf.
Oh, good
on
guy.
On this podcast. Yeah,
really great guy.
Yeah, it's a cool company.
Very much.
So interesting. It's overwhelming, some of the projects they do. But
yeah.
Talking about overwhelming, let's shift into employees. Yeah. So you start this brewery, you get the space, you're all building out. Now you got to hire people. How did that go?
Initially, it was exciting and great and kind of easy because we had a small group. You know, it was really just Alex was here day to day, and our friend Tom, the artist, was behind the bar like a bar manager right away for us. So it was our small group of guys that were pretty focused. Ryan could do all the production we needed to do by himself because we were just kegging beer at the time, and most of the backspace was empty. So it was a pretty small group. We had a couple extra people helping bartend and cook. And that team started to grow and over the next 6 to 12 months. And a lot of those early headaches Alex dealt with, you know, it wasn't me dealing with.
Nice.
And, you know, but it pretty quickly becomes clear, you know, how important your people are.
Hugely.
Early on, we were here every weekend, you know, Saturdays. We would be closed Sundays just to give ourselves a day away. And, you know, once you start to realize, like, hey, we really got to figure out how to have people around helping us get this done, or we're never going to make it. We're never going to grow. We're going to burn out. But it's people's really the whole thing, I think, in the end.
Yeah, without them, you have a job.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And speaking of ceiling, right, when it's just you, there's only so many hours in a day. So when you start adding people, you can raise that ceiling.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole game. It's that execution that I mentioned, that really most of that is just, can you find a way to bring together a group of people to do something, whatever it is. Get organized and do it.
Yep. So I know that when I first started my businesses, The employee thing was something that I did not know was such a headache. I learned the hard way. So did you know from project managing and stuff like that, that employees could be a challenge?
Yeah.
Okay. You're lucky.
When I would manage teams, it was each little project was like its own little mini company within it, when in general contracting. So like the last project that I completed, Moderna over Milwaukee, we had a project management team. I don't know, about a half a dozen people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, at peak, we probably had 400 or 500 people on the job site. And I think overall worked with 2,000 or 3,000, you know, different people touching the job. And, you know, you have all the foremen and the superintendents and the project managers of all those other various subcontractors.
Mm-hmm.
So being in a team environment was never, that was not a shock at all.
All right.
Probably the bigger thing, I was, to be honest, I was a much better manager in that life than I am here, because it's people, but it's not just people. It's the fact that you're really responsible
for
every part of that.
Yes.
Payroll, mm-hmm. the HR, the health insurance, the unemployment issues, the everything issues.
Mm-hmm.
All of that. And then career development and mm-hmm. morale and direction and
the whole culture.
And then in this business it's real dynamic, because you have different things going on. You have your manufacturing staff
mm-hmm.
versus your tap room and front of house staff. And mm-hmm. even in the front of house, there's this dynamic between when we used to have our kitchen open and the front of house, back of house, and mm-hmm. our retail component, that you just have these very different little subcultures,
yeah.
you know, within one business that,
mm-hmm.
and then to deal with all of these issues, that really made me appreciate when I was at Findorff how much stuff was being handled for mm-hmm. us to run jobs,
mm-hmm.
all of the administrative and accounting and HR and the training and the other stuff. I think people would be really kind of surprised, shocked at how much bad news comes to you as the owner of the company.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty much in the bad news business, right?
Yes.
The fire putting out. If it's really bad, that's like everything we get. And
mm-hmm.
it's always really bad when it's a bad thing with a person, whether, you know, they have like a family member pass away, or, you know, dealing with COVID and trying mm-hmm. to keep us moving forward, but without taking undue risk. And
mm-hmm.
Trying to make sure you take serious, you know, your role as the person taking responsibility for their job.
Right.
Without being taken advantage of, because
mm-hmm.
firing's really difficult, hiring's really difficult.
So. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's crazy.
The team dynamic wasn't a shock, but all of those other things it can be very overwhelming.
Yeah. I imagine in a place like this, just the culture alone is probably tough to manage.
Yeah.
Because you want, especially, I don't know what it's like now, but a year and a half ago, when unemployment was so low, you're tough to find people.
Very difficult. Very difficult. And you would have, there's always a certain amount of people that are sort of professional at gaming the system,
mm-hmm.
you know, at applying, or maybe applying so that they can still justify getting
yep.
unemployment, or they have to show up for maybe one shift.
Yeah.
And just to extend
cost
their
hours of
unemployment
paperwork.
You know, benefits, so that they can, you know, keep staying on that, and then they bail out on us. And now that's more of the exception, but it is a dynamic of,
totally.
of the industry. And
mm-hmm.
Overwhelmingly though, people are here doing a great job, and they're
mm-hmm.
not trying to take advantage of anything. They're really trying to help grow the brand. They're excited about beer. They're excited about the fun branding that we have. We
mm-hmm.
we try to keep in balance some chaos, you know, because I think
sure.
a lot of people are in the beer industry because they want it to be a little bit more wild, a little bit, you know, less structured, a little more creative, a little more of like riding the dragon here of
yeah.
you know, of creativity and whatever our brand gets to be. And that can be an interesting balance of trying to bring less formality into a business structure and allow for a little more chaos without it being a total mess.
Right.
You know, that's a balance that Ryan and I have talked about a lot of, what we don't want to have too many policies and things, because we want people to they're here for a reason. If, mm-hmm. if they wanted a bunch of structure, they'd go sell insurance or something right. and probably make more money, but they're here because they don't want to be miserable. Mm-hmm. They want to be feel a little bit more alive. And
right.
But it's a real balance. It's a real balance.
Oh, that's interesting. It's interesting dynamic, I guess, that you stated there, because in my industry, our rule is to systematize everything.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's something to be said about what you got going on. I might have learned something here.
I feel you. Engineering's the same way. I was all about how efficiently can we build a building, how, mm-hmm. how cheaply, how not inexpensively, I should say, not cheaply, inexpensively, fast.
I guess there comes a
everything
point.
With speed and efficiency and lean and right. here it's okay. We have that stuff. We do need procedure and process to repeatably make good beer, mm-hmm. to do a lot of things right, but we have to be real careful not to steal the soul, because
right.
the whole business is based on
totally.
That here.
Yeah, I can see if you're building a building, there's rules that you want to follow if you want the building to stay up.
Yeah.
Whereas beer, there's somewhat of an art, and it's also a lot of customer service.
Yes.
Which there are guidelines, but they don't necessarily have to be
hard rules, yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah,
there can be personality in there.
Yes. It requires personality. Mm-hmm. It requires authenticity, and authenticity requires people to be to inject themselves into the solutions, mm-hmm. into the service, and to be real with people.
Yeah.
But we fail all the time at that stuff. It's a really kind of wild balance of enough structure, enough guidance, so mm-hmm. that people aren't totally confused or feel like they're floating through space with what we're trying to do. which honestly, we fail it all the time. But mm-hmm. I think we tend to slightly err on that loose grip side,
sure.
know, to try to keep. Because at the end of the day, we also think that the most talented people will find ways to shine if there's a little
fair.
Less control.
Totally
we might find that person that could just change the game.
Yes. That is 1,000 times over.
Yeah.
Totally agree with that. Tell me about the name. Where did the name Carbon 4?
Carbon 4. That was 6 months of discussion, of long
wow.
discussion. We probably spent more time talking about what our name should be than anything else in that pre-planning stage.
That was the battle?
It was more of this discovery than it was like total battle. I think we were all a little bit confused on what did we really want. Because...
Mm-hmm.
To take it back, we had discovered this space and this exact plan
mm-hmm.
at the end of 2011 was when Ryan had called. I think when we came to meet with the Ill Asylum and the landlord was the Halloween of 2011.
Okay.
So by, I think about March of 2012, we had financing and lease signed and everything figured out.
Wow.
Well, we had from March 2012 until October to move in.
All right.
And they were here, so there's nothing we could do.
Yeah.
It was just talking.
It was just a waiting game.
We spent those 6-7 months just totally focused on what's our branding. I mean, there were certainly equipments and things that we were also, you know, putting together. Ryan mm-hmm. was shopping for and stuff, but a lot of what we were talking about were what's our brand, what's it gonna, whatever, what's it gonna be, look like, feel like, sound like, what's our approach, what's our strategic approach, and you know, beers we're gonna bring out, what's gonna be our first lineup, how are we gonna do seasonals,
mm-hmm.
and the brand, we knew that we wanted something scalable, that we didn't want to be painted into a corner with
yeah.
like a thematic brand. I think the joke is that we always said we don't want like a Disney ride brand.
Oh, sure.
You know, if it's like Cottage Brewing Company and then everything's like canoe paddle and paddle bolt and what
right.
you know, it's like all these themes. Well, mm-hmm. we didn't want to do that. We don't want to be painted into a corner, because who are we going to be in 5-10 years? You know, we want something that'll grow with us.
Mm-hmm.
And who do our customers say we are? Because the brand, the sort of spirit of our brand and who we were going to be as a company was going to be defined by our employees and by our customers
right.
and by us all together,
mm-hmm.
trying stuff, you know, failing, succeeding.
And that could evolve, right?
Yeah, it has to.
Yeah.
We really want it to. So we needed a point of view, and it needed to be us, but it needed to be something that would grow and
mm-hmm.
scale and wouldn't pigeonhole us. And so that led us to kind of want to sort of invent a word, you know, or find a brand
yeah.
that didn't feel like it meant anything until
right.
except for us. And this idea of elemental carbon being the foundation of our physical existence and then beer being the foundation of civilization was this idea that it was very elemental, that it was very I like to say principled but not traditional. So very limitless potential, even right. though very principled fundamentals.
All right.
So elemental carbon was, there was an idea that was captured by that, mm-hmm. but we didn't want to sound like a biotech company. And it just didn't look right to us, the regular, you know, CARBON, where, you know, both me being an engineer, Ryan being like pre-med, O-chem, you know, mm-hmm. very technical with chemistry and biology, with just didn't feel like a brewery. And right. Our friend Tom wrote, we had this long list of ideas, and he had written carbon 12 one time, all lowercase carbon, but spelt it K-A-R-B-E-N, and then 1-2, and it was like, it was on the list, but it wasn't a real serious contender,
mm-hmm.
but I think we all sort of secretly had our eye on it, because all of a sudden it came back to the top, and was like, you know, this really captures this idea we keep talking about, this mm-hmm. very, like, limitless potential idea, but we wanted to change the number, and so we started debating the finer points of that, but I think we were sitting at Salatai in Fair Oaks having an awesome meal and a few beers, and we just agreed. We're like, it's carbon four. We're just doing it. You know, we like the smelling, we like the way it sounds and looks, and we like K4 shortened, and
nice.
And we felt like it wouldn't bring any preconceived bias or notion, you know, mm-hmm. to itself. You'd just kind of say, what's that? And so it's one of those, like, it can only mean us. It can only mm-hmm. be one thing, because it's a little bit strange. And carbon four could be carbon four brewing, could be carbon four distilling.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, we could really grow with it. So
yeah,
it's really just meant to be a thing that we, like, pushed away from the dock, and we'll see where it goes. But that's some of the inspiration for it. So
I have to apologize, because I'm not a chemist. Mm-hmm. So the four, is that representative of anything?
Yes and no. At the end of the day, from a brand strategy standpoint, no, it means nothing.
Okay.
I think a lot of people, there must be four of you, or right. there are four valence electrons in sure. carbon, and that's part of why it, you know, bonds the way it does, and why it's so foundational. So probably the closest inspiration is the valence electrons in carbon, but it's not meant to be literal. It's,
gotcha.
It's meant to be a brand, and we like the way it looked, and the angularity with the K and,
sure.
and the sound, so...
It's just a name. Don't read into it.
It's really just a name. It's meant to be its own thing. And we can be a little grumpy about that sometimes, because it always gets misspelled. If there's a space between carbon and four, we hate it. But
sure.
together, we loved it. So we really didn't pick a great brand for a lot of those little, like, nuisance reasons.
Sure.
And when we explain it to people, usually they kind of stare at us blankly. And it's like, so are there four of you? It's like, no.
One more time.
But it's meant to be its own thing.
All right, cool.
Its own thing. Cool. Yeah.
Let's talk about the beer. So you guys start out, I imagine your brother had some ideas for flavors
and
styles of beer.
Yeah.
So how was that figured out? The first batches.
Ryan was the lead on that all the way. He had a whole bunch of different beers that he knew he wanted to make, and we deliberated over what would be sort of our early attempt at flagship versus some seasonal programs. So
right.
what we did is we brought out, I believe we brought out five flag, that the idea was the first five were going to be flagship type beers. And it was our Night Call Smoke Porter, our Tokyo Sauna was a Rye PA, or I'm sorry, Samurai Rye PA. Later we evolved to Tokyo Sauna. Undercover Session Ale, Lady Luck Imperial Red, called it an Irish Red at that point, and Block Party Amber Ale. So we wanted the spectrum of like just good, well executed staple beers, and then we knew IPAs were really important back then, but mm-hmm. we didn't want to just be stuck with one. We wanted to bring it out as a regular rotator. So
mm-hmm.
our plan was that we were going to have like a IPA slot in the calendar, but have it change seasonally.
Oh, nice.
And our second IPA in that lineup was Fantasy Factory.
Oh, that's the big one.
And yeah, the world would not let us stop making that beer. So that's
a good problem.
Yeah, today it's 75% of our business. So
is it really?
We're still trying to work to diversify a little better, but it just took off and never turned back.
Wow, so, we make other stuff.
Well, yeah, we make hundreds of other beers, but that's overwhelmingly the big volume.
It might be the label.
Yeah, it might be.
It's a fantastic label.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So is your brother the one that chooses the stuff, or does that deliberate throughout the employees or customers?
At this point, it comes from all over the place. There's inspiration, tons of inspiration from the team internally. There's collaborative projects, you know, or people outside that have ideas. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, it's mostly Ryan and I talking about what do we want to make versus what's going on in the world around us, what have we already made, you know, and make sure that whatever we're bringing out is kind of in context of where does it fit in our program and how do we want to bring it and what do we want to call it. Sometimes we have real clear direction on a name and a style of beer. Other times we know we really want a certain style and we struggle a bit for the name, and it's a free-flowing process constantly. And now we're stretched way beyond beer, where there's this whole beyond beer category that hard seltzers and higher alcohol seltzers, and at some point in the future cannabis, you know, infused products of certain types, kombucha, tea, you know, there's all these beyond beer things that we're really excited about. So I'd say our plan right now is to find the right way to sort of narrow in our focus on our beer schedule and make sure we just really love every beer that's sticking around on our calendar, and not make sure there's no filler space, and then also grow some of these other segments alongside of it.
Nice.
So
that's cool. Yeah, it's interesting. They always seem to be coming out.
Constant. Yeah.
It's always some change.
The pace of innovation and change in craft is unbelievable. Yeah. When we first started, there were 1,800 breweries in the country. There are now like approaching 10,000.
Over the course of 10 years.
Yeah, and the amount of different beers that those breweries are making has also grown 10 times at a minimum. I mean, maybe 50 times. I mean, when we first started, we had, you know, 5 to 7 beers that we might be offering.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like initially just Fantasy Factory and Package, and then we'd add just one more, Block Party or Lady Luck. Now, we could put 40 or 50 different beers in a package a year, every year. And there are breweries that put out like anywhere from 2 to 4 a week.
Holy cow.
And they make just a tiny amount of it, and then they scatter it to the wind, and they do that twice a week to try to sort of reverse engineer some volume. So it's a very different game than it used to be, and it's basically impossible to actually find something truly unique as a producer. If you make something, I mean, every fruit combination and yeast combination has pretty much been tried 100 times at this point. So I think we're getting to a place in craft where we really have to like make sure you narrow in on your point of view and the things that you're best at, and make sure to build that solid core business, and then so that you don't lose the soul, kind of the chaos element of before, like really design your seasonal program in context of all this stuff going on.
Right, like what's your niche?
Yeah.
Kind of thing, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Tell me, I want to shift into marketing.
Yeah.
So when you first started your business, you had to get known, and you had to say, hey, we're not Ill Asylum. You had to say, we're new on the block.
Yeah.
Like, how did you go about marketing and getting the name out there, both retail-wise and on store shelves?
Retail-wise, it was kind of early days of Facebook and starting to put out some video content like on a Facebook page, and did a little bit of paid direction just to like make sure that, hey, we're this new page on Facebook exists, and so definitely bought a few clicks early on just to sort of put us on people's I don't think there was even a news feed back then, put us on whatever that was, I can't remember, 10 years ago.
Okay,
but to help just say, hey, we're here. So there was a little bit of that, the sort of like Gen 1 social media stuff. And then the rest of it was just community outreach. We hooked up with the Madison Homebrewers and Tasters Guild. They're the people that put on Great Taste, and we got on their radar early. to get into the Great Taste our first year. We got into the Isthmus Beer and Cheese Festival on our grand opening day. So we had just opened, but Alex back-channeled with Isthmus to get us into that festival so that we could be at the festival.
Yeah.
So getting out to festivals and tastings of every kind we could, you know, and it was be us behind the stand serving beer, talking about the beer till we were blue in the face.
Interesting.
So it was a lot of that grassroots kind of guerrilla style, just sampling people and then trying to create, you know, beer release stuff here in the tap room where we had a soft opening December 28th. And then every week for the next 5 weeks, we had a beer release leading up to our grand opening and a beer release. So tried to create buzz around new beers and a new taproom in town, and worked with the what was their name? It was a club, or I don't know if they'd call it a guild. I can't remember what it was called now, but it was like a mustache and beard guild or something.
Oh, really?
That we did a big party with here, because we undercover our beer was like mustache themed, and
funny.
So we threw this big party, and all these guys with crazy beards and mustaches came in and did like a big sort of like beauty competition, standing on the bar, you know, rating their beards and stuff. So it was just dumb stuff like that. You know, it was guerrilla marketing stuff, and then we knew that we wanted to first try to focus on getting people into the tap room so that we could personally meet people across the bar, so you had that first person interaction. So you had your lowest ceiling revenue in the tap room by far the highest margin.
All right.
And then you have your first person brand interaction with everybody, introduce ourselves right over the bar. Then it was self-distribution, keg only, in the Madison area, where Alex and Tom would go out and sell and deliver beer to the bars directly, so from the brewery.
Yeah.
But now it's the brewery guys talking to the bar buyers, the bartenders and things at bars and restaurants in Madison. So you had that second person interaction for people drinking our beer.
Yeah.
And but you have a little higher volume, a little lower profit. And then assigned a distributor so that they would take over that sales role. So you get into that more third person interaction with the brand, but you create some more scale. And then we wanted that to play out for a little while before we put beer in package, because we really wanted to make sure that we focused on draft business, meeting people as directly as we could before we have this, like, call it fourth person interaction of a package sitting on the shelf.
Right.
Who knows? You know, people picking it up may or may not know who we are, where we are, where we're from, and allow more development to come along, you know, in our story before putting stuff in package, and then buy us time to find our fire breathing unicorn in package too. So
that's awesome.
That at the end of the day, that really launched the growth of our business much bigger. So we really hunkered down for about a year and a half to do that smaller scale direct sales stuff with kegs.
Yeah.
And then once we put that fire breathing unicorn on a package and got package out on the shelves, we really just were off to the races.
Nice. So, I love that, how you built upon your success like that. That's super cool. That is awesome. What is the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome through all this? You're talking 9+ years.
I don't know. I think certainly going from 2,000 breweries to 10,000 breweries and from
competition.
10 SKUs to 100 SKUs a year.
Oh, wow.
That rapid pace of evolution, you know, on the shelf and just in the space has been a pretty difficult regular pressure to overcome and to stay in front of. You know, I think we grow as individuals quite a bit. So just growing and turning from this, you know, even though we still, like I said, I feel like we're infants, like just getting going. But the reality is we have gone from it's just us to more of a company, and we have you know, anywhere from, I don't know, 25 to 40 people on payroll. Pre-COVID we had more like 40. Now we've been kind of trying to build back some of those numbers, but we do have a lot of people involved and process involved. So just evolving as structurally, you know, how should we best manage ourselves and that balance of leadership and guidance and allowing for growth in the company. And so I think Yeah, there's the competition side, the evolving side, just the people issues. Even as owners, the three of us, the dynamics changed quite a bit. And and I'd mentioned our friend Alex a couple of times. He's no longer involved in the company.
Okay.
So there's a, you know, evolving through that sort of stuff. And and now I think focus is the big challenge. That's where I'm at. I heard, I think it was Jack Dorsey. There was a reference in a podcast or a book or something, but Jack Dorsey, the Twitter CEO, he, I think it was him, that he refers to himself as the chief editing officer. That it really, his job is to edit. You know, we should be, you know, the things that we have to say no to is my job as a leader. And that was a real, like, that was a real light in my brain of like, oh my gosh, I need to stop throwing out so many ideas and start taking away ideas so that we can flourish with more focus. So
interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
That's clever. Twitter seems to be doing okay.
Well, he Cash App too, and Square, I think, is him. So he's pretty smart guy, pretty busy guy.
If he's in Square, he's definitely doing okay.
Yeah.
Apparently, his money and credit card processing.
Yeah. And crypto. Cash App selling crypto. So.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Nice. Cool. Well, this has been super awesome.
Yeah.
Where can people find you? I know where we are, but...
Yeah, the tap room here is on the east side of Madison at 3698 Kinsman Boulevard. We're kitty corner from the McDonald's on 51. The DMV's across the road there, too. So the tap room's here, open 7 days a week. On the shelf, we're available all over the state.
Nice.
And a little bit of Minneapolis and Rochester, Minnesota, and maybe some other Midwest states over time here. But primarily, we're focused on Wisconsin. And we're available in every corner of the state. Woodman's, Quick Trip, Pick and Saves, all the big chains. Walmart's really been a great partner here over the last couple of years, expanding our distribution. Festival's been a great partner. Other independent shops like the Sendix and the now I'm gonna start leaving people out. The Metcalf's have been great.
Sure.
So just tons of. Most places you can buy beer in the state, you're going to find something from us.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And seltzer.
I think that alone has got to be an accomplishment.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of work.
Stories of other breweries that are trying to get in places and stuff like that. It's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of hitting the ground. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a website?
We do. Carbon4.com. Yep. Carbon4. K-A-R-B-E-N. The number 4.com is our website. We're on Facebook, Twitter.
Nice.
Instagram, all that stuff.
Can people, I don't know what the laws are with alcohol, can they order it online?
Unfortunately, they cannot.
They cannot.
I really, really wish. One of my big developmental things is finding a way to figure out e-commerce, and it's a big topic in craft right now because there are some states you can mail to, but not in Wisconsin. If we ever can, we will for sure.
Right.
But for now, you have to buy it. Buy it here or at one of our customers.
Gotcha.
Locations.
All right. So. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So currently in Madison, Wisconsin, ready to take over the world.
Oh, sure.
As soon as the laws allow.
Intergalactic domination. Yeah. Nothing less. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Zach. This is super cool. This has been Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes of business owners across the land. Authentic Business Adventures is brought to you by Calls on Call, offering call answering services for businesses all over the country at callsoncall.com. as well as Draw In Customers Business Coaching, offering business coaching services for businesses looking for growth. And of course, the Bold Business Book, a book for the entrepreneur in all of us, available wherever fine books are sold. We'd like to thank you, our wonderful listeners, as well as our guest, Zach Koga, the co-owner of Carbon 4 Brewing. Zach, this is cool.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
I'm excited. I'm all of a sudden very thirsty, so I love coming to breweries. This is so cool.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the website one more time?
Carbon4.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week. I want you to stay awesome. And if you do nothing else, enjoy your business.